Guy to talk. So be sure you talk loud enough so they can hear you online.
Where should I sit, Lucy?
For right now, if you want to kind of sit sideways, that's fine. And I'll get my phone out of the way.
Yeah, we definitely have a whole lot more people online
Yeah, I saw the email here.
than we
He's
didn't.
stuck in the football traffic. So, Elizabeth, your worst nightmare.
Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah.
but at least he's alive and well
Yes.
and on the
Yes, that's the
way.
important thing.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to welcome everybody to the, let's see, this is October, right? The October meeting of the National Capital Astronomers. And our main speaker today is going to be Dr. David Dvorkin, who's going to talk about George Carruthers, whom I met at Naval Research Lab. And I don't have a any big announcement list or anything like that today. However, do have some news items. Our Assistant Secretary Treasurer, Brian Tomich, has unfortunately, because of his work, has to move to Newport News. Oh, no, sorry, even farther,
Charleston.
Charleston, South Carolina. And looks like we're going to be needing somebody to step up for that. And let's see. Jay, are you there?
Jay's driving Dr. Dvorkin guy.
Oh,
So.
he's driving. Okay. So, all right. So, any announcements from anybody else? Oh, Jim, did you want to give a very short report from the Treasury Department?
Okay. Currently, we have 155 members in the club.
Wow.
Okay. However, 58 of those people have not yet renewed. If you break that down a little further, the other 58, 27 of them are people who have been club members for quite, some period of time. The remaining 31 are people who have joined in the last year or so. So anyway, so we need to get the word out to people to renew. I will be sending out an email to each of the individuals who have not renewed yet, just as a reminder. And as far as the club treasury is concerned, we're doing pretty well. I think with the revisions to our dues, we're basically standing still, holding our own pretty much. That also keep in mind that in,
Hey Jim, can you get closer to your microphone?
not much. That help?
That does.
Okay. I will speak at the microphone, at the little camera up here. Yeah, just to recap, we're with the revisions in our dues and also some charitable contributions, our treasury is remaining pretty constant. We do have some fairly significant expenses. We spend about $500 a year on liability insurance. We also spend for each member, we spend $6 with the Astronomical League for their membership. And then there are miscellaneous expenses such as posters for the sidewalk astronomy events, and also rewards or awards for the science fair winners, and also swag, as we put it, for speakers. So between those, with those that outflow and our dues coming in, we're basically remaining pretty constant. The basic balance right now is right about $15,000.
Thank you.
I have a question for him.
Yes.
Of say the last 10 years of the science fair winners, how many of the winners after their first year, the free year, have continued with us?
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot.
As far as I can tell, I think I've got one or two. I'd have to go back through a membership roster here just to check, but it's only one or two.
And actually, there's something we should do that's would be more helpful to those science fair people is if we actually talked to science teachers and got the word out somehow through the school system saying, hey, if you want some assistance with an astronomy related project, you know, here we are, we can help give you some ideas. That's actually harder to implement than it is to just go to the science fair. It's not nothing going to the science fair.
Okay, that sounds like a lot of work.
But the other thing, which is really quite, you know, quite rewarding all around, is a different story.
I'm just wondering how we can get more younger folk in.
Well, we're actually getting some more in through telescope making and the sidewalk astronomy. Okay. Speaking of sidewalk astronomy, Zach, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Of course. Can y'all hear me? I was just making
Yes.
sure the mic is working. It's been a productive summer with Sidewalk. I think we really took advantage of the good weather. I'll speak first of the Astronomy Festival at the National Mall. Weather wasn't so good for that one, but we got a lot better weather than we expected. We were able to see Saturn, and most people absolutely loved it. It was also really good to have all the NASA science teams literally on the other side of the mall, and you could talk to them as well. So they had like the teams that were running the rovers, James Webb, Hubble, the Nancy Grace Roman team. So it was really good for all of us to be kind of with them in the same area and have the public go to the telescopes, take a look, and then hop over and go to talk to the science teams. So really productive meeting there. Sidewalk Astronomy has, I really am very proud of not only what Guy has been able to do on this one, but more important, very importantly, Gail Gomez, who is, I'll let Guy do the actual news, but long story short, he's not going to be in the US for much longer. Gail, without Gail, Sidewalk Astronomy would have never come into fruition in the way it has. That corner on Mount Pleasant is where we are doing Sidewalk Astronomy is a special place. I feel like DC as a city has Mount Pleasant as one of its kind of tightest knit communities, and we're right in the middle of that. And we have been able to bring a lot of smiles and a lot of wonder into people's lives, I think, out there. And Gail, if you've talked to him for any amount of time, you get to hear his passion and his intelligence and the amount of knowledge he knows about this stuff and is able to educate the public about in an easy to explain way is amazing. It's not easy to communicate science stuff to a public audience, and he has done it flawlessly. So I just wanted to say that, he will be sorely missed here in the US, and Sidewalk Astronomy will continue. We have no intention of slowing anything down. If you are interested in Sidewalk Astronomy, you want to show people the stars and speak to the public about this sort of stuff, I highly recommend it. It is one of the most rewarding things as an amateur astronomer to do. So please come through. We could show you photos of the crowds that come through, the people who talk to us, the things we show people. It has been so rewarding, and we're lucky to continue going it forward with it. But I just want to shout out to Gail. He's one of the kings of that sidewalk, and we all really appreciate him. That's all I have, guy.
So thank you. Yeah, Gail is a young person. I met him as a, I think he was a 10th or 11th grader, and he's now graduated from high school. He's from Venezuela. His mom came here as a biomolecular chemist, working on a grant at the Smithsonian. That's done. So her visa is done, and they had been also on temporary protective status. And as you probably have heard, all the people on TPS, at least from most of the countries, Venezuela and Haiti, and I think Afghanistan, all have to leave in less than a month. So there's going to be a fundraiser to help him with his travel expenses at the something called the Lost Horizons Gallery. It's on Mount Pleasant Street. You'll be getting details from that.
Quick correction, guy. It's Lost Origins Gallery.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Right. So we've been doing some sidewalk astronomy in a number of places. We've done it at the waterfront in Georgetown. We've done it at Great Falls on the Maryland side, on the canal side. We've done it at in Tacoma Park. We've done it at the wharf, and they said, no, beat it. You don't have permission. And we've also done it at Mount Pleasant. And I would say that the positive reactions you get are by far the best there as any place. And it's just people happen to walk by, and it's a very heavily pedestrian used place. And people are very, very happy. We've had quite a few people, I think, join NCA as a result of the outreach stuff. I think it's more, you certainly get more people than at an average exploring the sky, actually, at that place. Let's see, with exploring the sky, I don't remember what weekend that is. Does that anybody know?
Wasn't it next weekend?
Well, that's why I'm asking. I
What's
think
that?
we're looking that up. I thought Jay was going to tell us about that. Elizabeth is looking that up.
18 October, which is next week,
Okay, so,
7:30. Yeah.
all right.
So 18 October and then 15 November.
Okay.
That's going to be fun. No King's Day. Everyone's going to be
Tired.
tired.
Yeah. Right. And I'm supposed to do a thing with some Girl Scouts, that thing. With concerning amateur telescope making, that's going pretty well. Number of people have made some very interesting projects. And Richard, did you want to talk about yours?
Fast 6-inch mirror.
Okay. Well, he's doing an F2.7 mirror, which is extremely challenging.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's challenging.
That is extremely challenging. Parabolizing that is no
Oh.
joke. Yeah. And he's definitely to be commended for that. And he's brought a number of interesting ideas because he's been working on this himself up until recently. And okay, that, let's see. Anybody else have any other announcements? Because we're waiting for the speaker. Apparently they have gotten caught in really bad traffic.
I got one more.
Okay.
One additional thing I forgot to mention on the sidewalk astronomy thing. This was in conjunction with the Mount Pleasant astronomers, but long story short, this might have been announced at the last session, but Gail Gomez and Adam Green, both of Mount Pleasant, they launched a collaboration with the Lost Origins Gallery for astrophotography in Mount Pleasant, where they basically, there's an alleyway that's behind a coffee shop in Mount Pleasant that's used as a public art space by Lost Origins. And there are now pictures of the H Alpha Sun, of stuff that's been seen from Mount Pleasant, of the moon, and a bunch of other things. And that's open to the public. So if you ever find yourself in the DC area in Mount Pleasant and want to see the impact of some folks who work with NCA, working for their community, I highly recommend you take a look. And I wasn't able to attend the opening, but Guy was. And of course, that opening came with telescopes and crowds. So I heard it was quite the magical night, hundreds of people. And everything you could possibly want out of a sidewalk astronomy event was there. So I just wanted to put that to people's awareness.
Yep, that was really fun. How many people have actually seen that yet in person? Am I the only person here? Go there. Really, really, really neat.
Lost Horizons.
Lost Origins.
Lost Origins.
Lost Origins.
But that's not where the exhibit is. Are you familiar with Mount Pleasant at
Not
all?
all that much.
Okay, well, it's
Never.
near 16th Street,
Yeah.
right? And near Harvard and Euclid and Irving Streets and stuff like that. And like he said, it's on an alley off of that. And they have these astro photos. One of them was taken by Brian, the solar photo. Really very nice.
Thank you. Yeah.
And a bunch of other ones. And they're, many of them are the size of these bulletin boards that you see there. And they were paid for actually by both Lost Origins and also by the Smithsonian, who that was part of the what do they call that? The Folklife Festival. They recruited him, Gael, and myself to put on a thing with homemade telescopes and sidewalk telescope because some of their people had just stumbled upon us, and particularly him, and were quite impressed because he's made now several telescopes and modified others and collimated Schmidt-Cassegrains. He's done it, not me, right? And he's the kind of kid, he actually got hired by the Pendry Hotel, which is on the wharf. I don't know if anybody's aware of this, but one of those ones down on the wharf, brand new. And they hired him to be in charge of a C8 on their rooftop lounge to show the people on exploring the moon night, which was a week from ago, full noon. No, Saturday. It was Monday night, my bad. And so it was kind of neat that at least got to make some money doing what he loves doing, which is showing people the night sky. But it's actually much more fun because I was there. Much more fun when you're doing on a street corner and you have random people and you have kids who are looking through an eyepiece for the very first time and they don't know quite where to put their eye. You have to show them how to do it. Yep, they put it right here. But some of them get it, and showing them the sun and in hydrogen alpha and with the other solar scopes like the sun funnel and white light filters, that's fun. Jeff, did you want to say anything about the thing at either Great Falls or Georgetown, Washington Harbor? You were at some of those.
Well, let's see. We do about once a month do sidewalk solar observing at the Great Falls Tavern Visitor Center at the CNO Canal. Now, last time was what, last week, 2 weeks ago.
I think it was on Sunday.
Right. It was rainy on Saturday, so we did it Sunday, which was a beautiful day for it. That only they Chong Wan and myself made it that day. Chong had the solar funnel scope. And I had my H Alpha one, and so a lot of people stopped by to look at the sun, and through our scopes. And of course we were there able to explain some of the features that they could see. I could not make it to the last the one at the wharf at National Harbor there, but that I did go the time before that. That I was kind of surprised at how busy it was there on a nice Saturday the afternoon. Then that development has lots of restaurants along the waterfront, with many of which have outdoor seating areas. We were set up literally right along the waterfront there, on sort of a promenade that they have. And again, many people stop by to look through our various telescopes. More people came out with telescopes that time. And so you may be able to say more about the most recent National Harbor there event.
Yeah, it's similar. And, at that thing in the daytime, actually, I think a smaller percentage of people actually stop than at night. At night, we have things that look obviously like telescopes, and they're asking, oh, what are we looking at? And
Where's
they
here?
will ask.
This way?
But it In the daytime, when they actually do get to look through the hydrogen alpha telescope, I
If I'm
find that
using your
they're.
computer, my thumb drive is in that bag.
Okay.
Red, green.
Okay. We'll make it a lot easier.
Yeah, so I find that people are, if they, generally speaking, they have never looked through a hydrogen alpha telescope. And if you got it tuned right, and you can see the
Let me get here, please.
filters and stuff, they are
First, we
always
do have to
amazed.
explain that it is an extremely narrow part of the spectrum in the deep red, where hydrogen gas emits and absorbs light, and that lets us see the detail that we can't see in white light. And that it is a highly specialized telescope just for doing that one thing.
No.
Okay, so our speaker has arrived, and he's going to be talking about George Carruthers, who I met a little bit when I was working at the Naval Research Lab when I was teaching Washington, D.C. public schools. They had a program at the time called the Science Engineering Apprenticeship Program. I'm not sure it still exists, but what they did is it engage.
Forgot about the football game, and I do not drive on the beltway at night. Oof. So, millions of cars.
So
Cars. That's why there were so many cars.
Yeah, football.
And we lost.
Yeah, so what else is new?
Yeah, I have no idea which one it is on here.
Well, especially going the other way on the Delphi Road.
Yes. No, exploring the sky.
Yes, please.
The Nature Center is closed
Yeah.
for obvious reasons. So I can't get a hold of them. I'm gonna go ahead with it. If the park police come by and they say we can't hold it, then we'll leave. If they don't come by, then we'll hold it. I do not have the permit. The Nature Center got the permit, and the permit is in the Nature Center, so I do not have access to it. So,
So we need to call the Mission Impossible team and break in and grab them.
yes, that's what we will have to do.
What we need to do is to get the government to stop shutting down. And I could say a lot of dirty.
You said they're exploring the sky on the first Saturday. I felt
No, no, it depends on when the on what the weather's like up on the moon,
I see.
et cetera. I pick
So it's
the
not
time to.
variable.
It varies. I try
Okay.
and pick the same day during the month, but
Yeah.
it does vary.
Okay. So you try to get it on the first
quarter or last
yeah,
quarter?
Somewhere around the first quarter, because I like to have a little moon.
Yeah.
David, I don't know where your file is on
oh,
here.
Oh, yeah, let me. All right, of course, I have my computer here, but is this my
okay,
thumb?
So,
yes, this
okay,
is your thumb
you
drive.
see the NCA?
Aha. Yeah, well, actually, I did not notice the NCA. All right.
And you go to
newest or done?
But it always going.
Newest has the most.
Yeah, go to newest. And I'll get my script out.
Okay. Your bag is right there.
Oh, thank you.
Ryan was going
and
to
if you want to, you can,
you.
Yeah.
Yes, I've got his intro here.
All right, let me.
So you got my thumb drive, good.
Yeah, I've got your thumb drive, but what I'm going to do real quick here is maybe. Okay.
I certainly got a lot out of the CF program itself. I mean, I know the students did as well. I got to work with people who were doing gamma ray astronomy, which I didn't even know was a thing. We didn't know it existed.
All right, I'm going to start sharing.
What kind of astronomy?
Gamma ray. So they're using the oriented scintillating spectrometer experiment on. What was the name of that? They brought it down, a big telescope, gamma ray telescope. Compton.
Compton, yeah.
The Compton, right. So I got to work on a little piece.
Let me start screen sharing.
Gamma ray large area space telescope.
That works.
Well, yeah.
Oh, do you want me to?
Let me get this started, and then you can sit there. I'm gonna probably, but you'll want to sort of speak up so that they can hear you online as well. And
well, maybe I should be over there.
But yeah, so you can sit here. I was just trying to get this started.
It's my talk.
Yeah.
Brian, you still there?
Hello, everybody.
I'm still here.
All right.
It's been crazy.
Just patiently waiting.
Yeah.
No worries at all.
All right. Do y'all see anything or?
We see the kind of the speaker's pane, Elizabeth, with the.
Okay, gotcha.
The control center for PowerPoint presentation mode.
All right, so the first slide is blank.
Hit there. Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, so you don't have a mouse that in okay. I have to use the computer.
Yeah.
Because I have a whole lot of little animations.
All right. And
Delta?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. All right. See there. And just speak nice and loud into it. We should be all good.
Okay, I can yell.
That's recording this, right?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let me just make sure I'm organized here. Can I turn this around?
Yeah, you can turn it towards me a little bit more.
And what I need, it says you are screen sharing, I guess.
Yeah, because it's on Zoom.
Okay.
We've got about 15 people online. And so
all right.
You're seeing the screen of what we're seeing.
Dr. Dvorkin, I'll introduce you, and then we'll kick off the presentation.
Brian, speak up.
Can you all hear me?
That's a bit better.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
I
Dr. Dvorkin, I'll introduce you, and then we'll kick off the talk there. Thank you so much with us this evening.
Down button.
Right, oh, that there. One. Okay.
Yeah, that's like I do.
If you all could turn up the, yeah. All right. So tonight we're honored to welcome Dr. David Dvorkin, Senior Curator Emeritus for the History of Astronomy and the Space Sciences at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. Dr. Dvorkin has spent decades chronicling the evolution of modern astrophysics and space science, curating landmark exhibitions such as STARS from Stonehenge to the Space Telescope, V2, the world's first ballistic missile system, and Explore the Universe. His work has helped generations of museum goers connect the dots between ancient stargazers and today's space telescopes. He was instrumental in creating the Phoebe Waterman Haas Public Observatory. And I have to say, on a personal note, I was very sorry to see that taken down during the renovation, but hopefully that will be back soon. And bringing hands-on astronomy education to the public, and continues to shape the museum's future through collaborative exhibition redesigns. With over 18 books and 125 scholarly and popular articles to his name, Dr. Dvorkin is not only a historian of science, but a storyteller of the stars. He holds a PhD in the history of astronomy from the University of Leicester and a Master of Philosophy in Astronomy from Yale University. This evening, he'll be giving a talk titled From the Laboratory to the Moon, which tells the story of a quiet genius who designed and built a telescopic camera spectrograph that was taken to the moon by Apollo 16, becoming an inspiration for underserved students to pursue science and engineering. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. David Dvorkin, a curator of cosmic history and a champion of public understanding of our place in the universe. Dr. Dvorkin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Okay, I'll get used to this machine here. So it's the down arrow. Okay, that is the question that has been guiding me for quite some time, starting in the late 1980s, when I was interested in documenting the origins of the space sciences. And so let's move on. To answer this question is, of course, George Carruthers, who I'll be talking about tonight. And here is a composite of his camera on the moon, and that's George right there. So now let's meet George. Now, what? Let's just hope it works. I have videos with audio. Let's see. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, that's why. I usually try to get here.
There we go.
Well, I'm at the National Air and Space Museum today, and we're standing in the Apollo to the Moon Gallery. And I'm especially excited today because I'm standing in front of the first astronomical telescope placed on another planetary body, in this case, the moon. But the real exciting thing today is that we're standing here with the person who thought it up and designed it and built it, George Carruthers. George, what is this thing over here? I understand it's two telescopes in one, but it doesn't look like the telescope I built when I was a kid.
It's an ultraviolet camera telescope. And the reason why it's an ultraviolet telescope is because that allows us to observe parts of the sky that would not be possible with an ordinary visible light telescope. And that has also the capability of operating in the vacuum. We wanted to observe objects from space and being able to observe stars and the Earth's upper atmosphere from the moon.
Because the moon doesn't have an atmosphere itself.
That's right.
When you look at the object, it's gold, right? Yes. But is it solid gold or just coated in gold?
Just coated with gold so it doesn't get eroded.
Right.
And disruption by high energy radiation.
And I notice it has a lot of handles on it and knobs and dials. So it was meant to be used by astronauts on the moon. How did the astronauts learn how to use it?
They came to our laboratory at Naval Research Laboratory here in Washington, D.C., and we showed them how to operate the instrument and what we wanted to have done in terms of objects that they would observe from the moon.
It must have been a very exciting time for you when the astronauts finally landed on the moon and deployed your telescope out there. Where were you at that time, and what was your job?
Well, I was at the mission control here on the Earth, of course, and we gave information to the astronauts and got the information from them so that we could find out if we had to make any changes or find out what kinds of pictures they were getting from their operations on the moon's surface.
What objects did you observe? I understand the Earth was one of them, right?
We were taking pictures of the Earth's upper atmosphere from space, which was something that had not been done before, and also to stars and gases in the universe in far ultraviolet light.
Did it tell you anything that was new about the upper atmosphere?
One of the most important things that we had not expected to see was that Hydrogen, which is the lightest of all gases, extends above the Earth's atmosphere to very large distance.
And you looked at other stars too.
Yes, we did, to observe the stars and their radiations in ultraviolet light, which is not possible from telescopes on the Earth's surface.
And what did that ultraviolet light part of the stars tell you?
One of the important activities that we made was to also observe ultraviolet radiation from stars and other objects in space that were not possible from the ground. And some stars are very much hotter than our sun, for example, may be totally invisible to telescopes on the Earth's surface. But when you go out into space and observe in the ultraviolet, you can determine that these very hot stars at very large distances exist that would not have been possible from the Earth's surface. Of course, we couldn't tell them what results were obtained because that's a camera that you have to fix on the Earth after the astronauts bring come back.
Okay, I hope that gives you an introduction to the general talk. And this was a series of interviews that Smithsonian put together to try to document all of the museum's galleries. Very few of them actually got noticed in the in public. They didn't follow through. So this is a nice little piece of history, and I thought you'd like to at least meet George, and I'll have some others. Now, George was born in Cincinnati in 1939 to George Archer Carruthers, who was a civil engineer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and Sophia Singley Carruthers, who was a librarian and a post office worker. They're both college trained and very, very, you might say, into earthy activities, especially the father, who had memories of being on a farm when he was a kid. And so pretty soon, the father moved the family out of Cincinnati and moved them to Milford, Ohio. And that was, you can see them on the lower left. There's three brothers. George is in the middle there. But most poignantly is that interesting little picture on the lower right. That's George. I had to do some AI to get him above the noise in the background. I didn't do the AI, a friend did. But he's looking at the sky with a soda bottle. And that sort of characterizes George. That's how I want to present him to you. Everything that George did was hands-on. And his father gave him a lens, and they made a telescope together. His father was very handy, and George got used to using tools and everything. But the first thing he did was he set grass on fire. So that's an introduction to George Carruthers. Now, George's father sadly passed away in 1952. It was a shock to the family, and Sylvia Singley, mother, could not support the family on this farm in Milford, Ohio. So they had to move back to some place where she would have support, and that was her family in Chicago. So they all moved up to Chicago. And as you can see right here, George by then was about 11, 12 years old, and he was already building telescopes, and he had an absolute ball at the Adler Planetarium in their telescope making shops. And they have courses, they had courses for mirror making, that sort of thing. And George just really excelled in that. Where do I go here? Okay, well, through his training, he was always very actively involved in laboratory work of all different kinds. And here you can see that on the lower right, well, actually, it's on the lower left, he's even working in a laboratory he built in his mother's basement. And it was a study of plasmas. how plasmas behave, and how metals behave when exposed to plasmas. And what he was interested in by the time he got into college was to use plasmas for various diagnostic work. And one of his first projects was to determine, well, what kind of metal do you need to be able to survive re-entry? And that was something that caught the eye of his university professors. And he ended up writing his thesis on the degradation by plasmas. But he also was very interested in using plasmas for all sorts of different activities. I like to think of him as I do with a number of scientists. You invent a hammer and everything looks like a nail, Okay. Well, George did very, very well in at Illinois. He graduated with his he got his bachelor's, his master's, and a PhD there. His bachelor's was actually in aeronautical engineering, but he continued moving more and more into astronautics.
Went to the University of Chicago?
No. This is University of Illinois.
Okay.
Yeah. No, he only went to the University of Illinois all three through, and that happens to be where his family went. I mean, they're just really, oh, you probably know that there's the Carruthers Geocorona satellite.
Satellite
Yeah.
just went up.
Yeah. And the PI is at University of Illinois. And I've been in contact with her, and they're very proud of her. As he got toward his thesis, his professor at the time recommended. Oh no, actually, yeah, sorry. He was looking around for what to do next, and like they have bulletin boards in various halls, in labs and stuff, saying, you can go here, here, here. He saw a notice from the Naval Research Laboratory, and it really, really excited him. And when he mentioned it to his thesis advisor, he absolutely, agreed, yes, that's it. There was also at least one lecturer that Milton Rosen, who lectured at Illinois, and George came into contact with him. Now, George, I mean, NRL was ready to pick him up right away and have him finish his thesis at NRL. But George wanted to stay in his own lab at Illinois, and he finished up there. And then right after that, he was accepted as a postdoc at NRL in the E.O. Hulbert Center. Hulbert was the guy who pretty much started the scientific research work at NRL in the 20s, and he's an absolute legend. What we're looking at now, of course, is NRL in the upper left, and Herbert Friedman in the lower left with George and one of his payloads. And the story here is that, as you may know, NRL was a leader in X-ray astronomy from the late 40s, starting in 49. They didn't do the spectacular thing of detecting the first non-solar stellar point source, but they got close. Riccardo Giacconi did that. That's another story. But anyway, Herb Friedman was the fellow who was running the program, and he was very, very well known at that time. And he had a group post-war that had been doing rocket sond research using V2s and Arabes and the whole thing. And his primary detector is essentially a Geiger counter. You can see it there in the picture. That's a ultraviolet one, mainly because you can see the anode inside the window. If you can't see the anode, if it looks like aluminum, it's an X-ray detector. So it's all about how you filter things out. And you basically have a circuit there that receives photons and amplifies them into a current. So that's what we're talking about. That's the kind of physics we're talking about. Let's see. Okay. Now, what I was very interested in doing, this is even before I was working with George Carruthers, this was in the 80s. I was, I think I mentioned, writing a book on the origins of the space sciences in the V2 era. It was called Science with a Vengeance, published by Springer. And well, I'm happy to say it's a well-regarded book. Well, where did it all start? It started in the Naval Research Lab. And I found the first generation space scientists from NRL to and interviewed them both for their oral histories, but also with their equipment. And this is Charles Johnson, he was a wonderful fellow. He was a volunteer for many, many years at the museum. That's where I first met him. And he probably got me interested in this whole thing anyway. And Johnson is, and I want to just show you some stuff here. I hope we can do it quickly. Of what kind of environment NRL was for Carruthers walking into it. I mean, it was pretty clear he was not interested in university work. He was not a teacher at that time. And he wanted to work in a laboratory. And it was all about being in a laboratory that had a philosophy that, as you can see, is testing, 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 making things work. Now let's see if this works. Because I interviewed Charlie and
Were these diagnostic procedures all written out and you had something like a checklist and you'd check off each of the electronic components to make sure they're working under the conditions of flight?
Maybe not so much a checklist. Did everything come out on the telemeter signals as you wanted to see them? Was it all there? Was there any noise? Did anything look bad or was everything good? It was a matter of just, were you satisfied?
And how long would that procedure take? How quick is the process? If it worked right.
A lot longer than it's taken me to tell you. It's weeks. It's all right. You go through to do a thing like this, we learn that you constantly keep testing. Testing, testing to see that everything stays just like you want it. The last test is when you fire it. And if we didn't take that attitude on it, we got into trouble.
Okay, I hope this works. The video is longer, but if I did it right, this takes us to the next slide and another group of NRL people who were the first generation. E.T. Byram and Robert Kreplin, they worked directly for Friedman, doing X-ray work and also point source UV detection of objects using Arabes, and that was their primary. But that's the only one they would talk about. There were other vehicles, but we just didn't talk about them. Long stories. Okay, well let's now listen to that one. Uh-oh.
These were flown in, I think, 19 version of this from 1953 up in on
Windows closing.
rock combination up in the on trip up to Thule Green.
Up in green.
Yeah.
Now I am curious that this does have the anode that is only supported at one
Yeah,
end.
that's right.
So had you solved the problem of
There we go.
ruggedness with is it a thicker anode?
The anode's fairly thick in this, and of course it's much shorter too.
Possibly we can get
You'll be
another
able to
shot.
see the animal.
Yeah.
Is that section?
Okay. Well, George's postdoctoral work was mainly to assess the status of Friedman's detectors. But he was told by his Illinois professors and others that what he really had to do was improve them and go beyond point source detection to image detection. And what he eventually came up with quite quickly were what you would call electronic graphic instruments. He didn't invent the concept of combining optical and electronic data gathering and focusing, but he improved on them and made them reliable and also rugged enough to be flyable. That's the key. I mean, I can go on and on about the precursors, but let's just stick with George. This is his basic design. You basically have a what you might call a Cassegrain type telescope, and some people said, well, he had Ritchey Chretiens, he had Schwarzschilds, he tried all sorts of combinations, looking for balance between power and field of view. The difference, though, is that the secondary mirror, which of course is convex in all of these, is not a mirror, but it is a cathode. It's a photocathode. It's coated with front surface light sensitive material. It turns it into an electron beam, and the focusing magnet above it or around it sends it down back through the mirror, the mirror hole. And there is electronic sensitive film there. That is the basic technique that he developed and made extremely rugged. That's the key here. Not only was it direct imaging, but he created a simple, but I mean, I should say elegant way to produce spectra. He used objective grating type designs. The plane grating would get the light and disperse it into the telescope. The telescope would again focus it on the photocathode. The photocathode would convert it to an electron beam, which would be picked up by nuclear track film. And that's basically the basic technique that George used. Again, he wasn't the first one to do it, but he came up with designs that were rugged enough to fly on rockets, satellites, and also sensitive enough. And I can go on ad infinitum, but I'll spare you. Okay. Well, naturally, his first payloads were with Arabes, and here is a an image of one of the NRL's early Arabi rockets using George's detectors. Now, what we're looking at is a test setup where the cylinder on the left is not the telescope or anything. It's a light source, a laboratory light source. And what he's doing is he's testing using that lab light source, because that's where the light would go in, and see how the equipment reacts to it. And so he could calibrate it that way. And that was his fort, I guess you'd call it, because it was very, very quickly apparent that he could make these things, build them, and make them work just about better than anybody at NRL. Yes. Well, anyway, I'll just go on. One of his early flights with a in this case, his electronographic detector with a spectrograph, a open tube spectrograph, was to detect molecular hydrogen in interstellar space. Now, that was a big deal at that time, because we're talking, in the 60s, and the question was, here we're getting better and better ideas of how stars evolve, but where does the material come from? I mean, the radio gives you the H1, and you can get your stuff like that, but the molecular hydrogen is not too active, but it is active in the ultraviolet, and you can see in the upper left there, it's a pretty poor thing. That blue arrow points toward molecular hydrogen in one of the spectra that George's camera produced. And you understand, this goes up in a sounding rocket, and if you're lucky, it floats down in a parachute and doesn't break itself apart when it lands. Now, there's millions of stories about that, and some pretty funny ones too. But anyway, in this case, he did confirm a good amount of hydrogen, and there was even an indication that it was not uniform, which is very important, but it was sort of associated with large clouds, the visible or radio clouds. And that turned out to be very important, The citations were quite frequent, and he got his first, you might say, accolades through this work, establishing that his instruments, his expertise, could produce new knowledge. Now, guess what? There was this place called the Stardust and National Capital Astronomers, right? Well, they invited George to give a talk, and it was about the molecular hydrogen itself. And I put this up just to say, was anybody here at that time? That was be 1970.
Yeah.
You could have been.
I was a member.
Okay. Did you go to the?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I don't.
Okay. But that was just the beginning of his work. I'd love to know who made that graphic of George. There's a guy named Isley there who's the vice president of the NCA. So,
pardon? Who was the editor of Stardust at the time? Do you know?
I don't know.
It was Bob McCracken the editor yet?
You can look it up.
Bob McCracken.
It does, yes.
Okay, well, he gained a certain amount of notoriety, you can see from this, and he put it to good use. He had his eye set on Apollo. And the one, should I say, problem or limitation of this design is what? It's film recording. That means you got to bring it back. So he became very interested in, should I say, human spaceflight. And the Apollo program fascinated him completely. Now, let me tell you why. The Naval Research Lab, one of their biggest duties is to meet the needs of the fleet, quote unquote. And one of the biggest needs was to be able to maintain and predict radio communications across the globe. That required knowing the reflectivity of the ionosphere. That required knowing how the ionosphere is affected by solar radiation. And that is exactly what all of these things started influencing. The fact that George got as far as he did quite quickly was because of this, the needs of the fleet. And that is something you can't find easily in print. I finally got clearance to talk about it. It's pretty ridiculous since it comes from the 60s and 70s, but they're always careful. Anyway, I now have George talking, and I hope this will work, but let me give you an introduction. George applied created a proposal to fly something on a Apollo craft, because then the film could be brought back by the astronauts. What NRL wanted was, of course, a better view, a global view of the Earth's geocorona. The problem was that no satellites or spacecraft had gone beyond the Earth's atmosphere enough to be able to look back and image the corona and to look at and monitor it as the sun changed. So that became George's mission. And of course, it was very, very strongly supported. And he wrote a proposal, but he was not alone. You know, there's a lot of competition out there, especially for Apollo berths. And here I've asked him what he was aware of at the time when he put his proposal in, because the way it all ended up, and I'll talk to you about it, required a little bit of searching because he couldn't do it alone.
Giving us a relatively concise, simply a concise review or introduction to how you got involved in the Moon Camera project.
Yeah.
The proposals for the Apollo 16 bar UV camera spectrograph experiment was submitted in response to an announcement of opportunity that NASA issued in 1969 for Apollo follow-on experiments to be conducted on the surface of the moon or in orbit around the moon. And I submitted a proposal at that time, and I didn't know it at the time, but Dr. Thornton Page of the NASA Manned Space Flight Center, as it was then called in Houston, now called the Johnson Space Flight Center, also submitted a proposal to do experiments from the moon using the same camera that I had developed for sounding rocket experiments. NASA reviewed those two proposals and saw that they used very similar equipment, so they suggested that we combine the two proposals. And Dr. Page and I were working together from that point on in a single experiment, which combined aspects of both his proposal and mine.
All right. I did a bunch of digging, and that's basically the story. But what George didn't appreciate, and I didn't make a big point of it, because actually I didn't know it myself when I interviewed him, but that hyped my curiosity. Thornton Page was a quintessential insider at NASA. He has quite an interesting history. I shouldn't spend too much time on him, but in the post-war world, he was in operations research. He was on the CIA's Robertson panel and the ad hoc advisory panel on UFOs from the standpoint of intelligence. He was, of course, a complete a skeptic about it, but he would debate people like our friend Carl Sagan down there. And it got to be pretty wild, and he became something of a moderate public figure. I know him. I knew him because I was his babysitter when he was on a sabbatical leave at UCLA when I was an undergraduate. And let me tell you, he was quite a character, but he was a player and a very, very interesting fellow. Anyway, so what George didn't quite understand was that Page already knew what George was proposing. And when Page proposed it to NASA, he didn't mention George at all. He mentioned it as his design. So that's just a little historian, keeps me in business. But we don't have to go any farther than that. I found that interesting. But that's definitely Thornton Page. Okay. Now, what actually happened was that George Carruthers decided, oh, yeah, well, Page wanted to fly two instruments, a telescope and a spectrograph, on two different mountings and everything. But, the Apollo berths just were not capable of it. Page himself, by the way, proposed a, what was it, a 10-inch F-12 Newtonian. Oh, it's just nuts, just nuts. What George did, because they wanted to do both direct imaging and spectra, is he found a way to put them together on one mount. And what you see on the upper left, let me get this working here. The camera itself is on a pivot. And when it's looking this way, it's imaging the sky directly there. But when you turn it from horizontal to vertical and it's looking down, there's a grating, objective grating, and it takes spectra. So on the same using the same telescope, you can do spectroscopy and direct imaging, and all the astronaut had to be all he had to do was simply know how to do it. Yeah, flip it one way or another. Lots of stories about John Young and Carruthers, but maybe for later. So anyway, this was his model. It cut everything in half. This is what NASA was really excited about, and it went ahead. And let's see, we get to the launch of Apollo 16, and guess what? Apollo gets to the moon, gets into the lunar orbit, and the stages have to separate, and they don't. There was a pretty big flub in one of the units holding them together, you know, the lander and the service module and stuff like that. And it was kind of crazy, and it led to a 6-hour delay before they could figure out how to separate it and keep the lander working with the instruments. And there's my happy thing. But what they had to do was that this didn't bother most of the experiments, but it certainly bothered those. I mean, the Earth was great because it wouldn't move over time in the sky, but everything else, the stars, everything else would move. And so George his colleagues hastily put together a finding chart for the 6-hour delay and reprogrammed it through Houston, giving the astronauts new coordinates. Now, John Young did all sorts of fun things. You know, he used to trip on wires and stuff like that. Well, this is one of the ones he did. But as this continued to work, and it was working beautifully, after maybe the second or third day, the azimuth of the telescope, it was an Alta azimuth, froze completely, just completely froze. And why did it freeze? Well, anybody ever see Destination Moon, the movie?
No, thank God.
Oh, that's come on.
1950.
Yeah, 51. Yeah. It's my favorite movie all time. I saw it first run.
Yes.
In my father's lap. But anyway, there is this scene where one of the antennae is broken, and they have to go out into space, you know, and fix it. And of course, they get into all sorts of trouble there, and that produces a fun story. Why did it break? Because an engineer, before the launch, greased it. And that was the story. So you don't grease anything that is exposed to space. And that was the story. But that's exactly what happened here. An engineer at Houston greased the azimuth axis. he never saw Destination Moon. I mean, you know. And it froze. That was really, really bad news. So what did George and John Young, George gave Young and the other astronauts directions for lifting the telescope and moving it back and forth in azimuth, but actually being able to hunt them, point directly to the things. I mean, the altitude worked fine. And if you turn the tripod, it worked. So that's how they did it. It was just an amazing, amazing thing.
Are those targets?
Yes. Those are different targets. What you see is the, that's the Descartes, Descartes Highlands there on the around the edge. And then that's where the different objects are in the sky. On the delayed time frame, these were the calculations they made. Okay, well, 6 hours after, of course, the calculations were done, and the rocket descends, or I should say, the lander descends and hits the Descartes Basin. The Highlands, I'm sorry. And you know, let me make sure I don't get lost here. Yeah. Of course, the instrument had to be placed in the shadow of the lander because it couldn't be exposed to direct sunlight. It would both blind it and also heated up enough. The fun thing about this image was I asked some people, how did you take the image? Why can you actually see it when it's in the shadow? Because, you know, there's no scattered light there. They said, this has been doctored. NASA's really great at giving you just what you want, you know. So, so the camera was placed in the shadow of the lander, there were three filters on the camera that the astronauts could move by design, of course, putting the camera behind three different optical ultraviolet filters. And when looking at the Earth, when they combined them and then used false color, of course, they came up with this famous image that everybody has been, used at the time, even though scientifically the important ones were the black and whites, taking three different wavelength regions to help map out the aurora in the geocorona, the very far distant aurora, and to watch it how it changed as sun as solar activity changed during the course of the observations from the surface of the moon. And that's what George did with his instruments.
I've never seen that before.
What? Which one?
I've never seen any of that before, those images.
Oh, you probably have had a full life. Well, I saw them when I was teaching at Central Connecticut State College, and got very interested in this stuff, and didn't do anything about George. I was still an astronomer. I wasn't a historian, but I was very interested in weather and solar influences, and so I knew a little bit about it. At least I remember the pictures, and it could well have been that there was a symposium at Yale or something at that time. Okay. Now, George's success at being able to produce a stronger connection between solar activity and the Earth's reflectivity, the ionosphere's reflectivity, and just the fact that he was able to do this amazing work on the moon brought him a lot of awards. You can see his Black Engineer of the Year, and that one up there, I can't quite read it. National something Hall of Fame.
Inventors.
Oh yeah, okay, thanks. It's really he got a lot of notoriety, and that'll be something I might be interested in talking about later. But by that time, something was also happening in astronomy. And that was that the technology was progressing, as you can imagine. I mean, what do we all use for detectors these days? CCDs? Yeah, well, let's have a look. There's a CCD that one of them that I collected from the Wide Field Planetary Camera that was returned to Earth that we also have, that I used to have. I'm no longer at the Air and Space Museum, but that's the sort of stuff we collected. It was kind of interesting. We found that even NASA was not too interested in making a big deal about the CCDs, but we were because of their legacy and the importance of them. I interviewed Lyman Spitzer, if you know that astronomer's name, very famous. He had proposed for the Wide Field Planetary Camera using traditional image detectors. And he was beat out by the CCDs.
Yeah, Nancy Grace Roman was the one who insisted that they use CCDs
That's right.
rather than the Vidicon.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Rather than what?
Vidicon. It's
Vidicon rather than video. Yeah.
yeah, the a photo
In Hubble.
well, yeah.
Oh, wow.
A Vidicon is like an electron a camera,
Yeah, a TV camera.
TV camera, yeah.
TV camera.
Yeah, with a vacuum in a vacuum tube thing. Long stories about that, but anyway, this gave him amazing notoriety and attention, but it also created a real problem. When you're wedded to a certain technology all your life, like he was to vacuum tube technologies and plasmas. When this totally revolutionary technology comes in, what do you do? Well, he tried to adapt it, and he did. but he was no longer leading proposals. He was on proposals. He was not, his reputation was, of course, wonderful, very good, but anything new, since it also had to be retrievable because of his film issues, became less competitive, let's just put it that way. He still flew stuff on Skylab and on Shuttle, of course, that because the astronauts could return this stuff. But he became less competitive. And how did he account for that? He didn't skip a beat, let's put it that way, because he reached out and, in a way, gave back to the community that he came from. He started and increased his attention to mentoring inner city and underrepresented kids in all areas. This is, I think, the University of Maryland's reflector there in the middle that many years ago. These are just different examples of the things that he would set up. Helped to develop various mentoring groups like the National Technical Association or the Project SMART and others like that. And he became very, very well known in them, mainly because most of them weren't run very well. And he was an extremely good organizer and a financial manager. And he helped them out of some pretty different times. But he lectured. This was his life. It became more and more of his life, even though he continued doing his science, of course. Now, when I arrived at the museum in 81, early, like January 81, I was sort of looking around, what's happening? And by then, the big news was that there had just been a revitalization of what is called the NASA-NASM transfer agreement. Anybody know about that? It's that if anything is declared excess property by NASA and does not have a scientific use, Air and Space gets first bid. And this went back and forth. It was really very crazy. But anyway, when I got there, as a result, NASA would periodically do a dump on the museum. There was a huge one in the late 70s. And it included some of the backups and the pieces from George Carruthers' camera. Because as Charles Johnson said, you test and test and test and test, and then you fly the one that you test. Now, the difference between NRL philosophy and NASA philosophy, according to them, although some NASA people have agreed, is the NRL people would build a number of engineering models, test them, and test the last one that they tested. If it worked, that's the one they flew. NASA didn't do it quite that way. They would test until they knew the design was correct, and then they would make another one of the same design, but didn't test them in any kind of... Didn't test them to destruction, I should say. I should be clear on that. The whole idea is how much grief will this instrument stand? And the way to know that is you test them in temperature variations, in mechanical motion, until they do break. So you know what causes them to break. NASA, according to the NRL people, didn't do it that way. They would fly something that had not been fully tested, certainly partially tested, of course. So that was the issue. And periodically, the Air and Space Museum would get, literally, I would like to think of them as core dumps, but this is before computers. And when I was there and I did some of my first inventories looking at things, it was pretty clear that, there was a lot of stuff that nobody knew anything about sitting in our storerooms and stuff. Now, when they arrive, they're not accessioned in any official way until somebody looks at them, works with them, gets their history and documents what they are, and then it becomes accessioned, an accessioned property. Well, these showed up, still not absolutely sure, but in the late 70s, they were in storage. I found them, I mean, along with others helping me, saying, you know, I think that might be astronomical, so why don't you figure it out? You know, that sort of thing. Did you know Derek Elliott? No, okay. He was the one who talked to me about it. But anyway, we found it, and then we accessioned it, and that's why it says 1983, even though the museum had it quite a bit earlier. And in there are a bunch of bits and pieces that you could put back together to produce the instrument. Once George helped us with that. I was already working with the NRL people and learned about George through them, knew about what he had done, but didn't realize that, you know, he was there, and I decided to put them all together. And so George also was very happy to volunteer because he was into his mentoring by then. And he was very, very delighted to be able to bring his students to the museum and to the shops in order to restore the instruments. And here you see he's working on the camera with one of his students. And I also video recorded him and at that time and got the students' reactions. So we have a pretty good record of that. Even more, George, he couldn't officially do this, but he effectively did this. He donated the original photographic cassette that was on the moon and brought back by the astronauts. He's holding it right there. We had to be sure that NASA was okay with that. I mean, George was, that was details for him. But he did it just as with his you know, feet on the floor. He wasn't an elitist in any way, but he said, well, you know, that's a very important piece, and I wanted to give it to somebody who I could trust. And we were putting these stuff on display at that time and reconstructing the camera. And he said, well, I think you should put the cassette in the camera. Cassette work, you know, the flown cassette. So that's what we have in the camera. We have the real thing. Now, the camera went through various exhibit cycles. When it was first brought in fact, before it was upgraded, we put it on the in the east wing where the lunar lander used to be. Anybody remember when it was in the eastern part of the museum? Yeah. And made sure we put the camera in the shadow of the lander. In other words, the window's over on the right, and we sort of put the camera on the left, and it sat there, and we had a little label, not very informative, but it was there for quite a few years. And then eventually the lander, as you know, was moved to the central, the gallery. And they didn't want to take George's camera with them, which bugged me. But they did put it in Apollo to the Moon gallery. And they switched it from being outside like that to being inside a case, which is, of course, good museum practice. And then one day, I mean, you know, after months and months, these museum conservation staff periodically checks everything that's on display. They open it up. They make sure everything's okay. And what did they find? When they opened this one up, they found there was a smell, a pretty acrid odor. Let me get to, okay, there it is on display in Apollo to the Moon. Oh, what did I just do? Help.
Hit the escape button.
Oh, over up here? Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Oh, no, come on. Yeah, I put it back into play.
Just take a second.
Okay, so the next down button. What's that smell? Thank you. That's exactly what the conservator was asking. People were asking. They said, could it be that the film inside the cassette is rotted? You know, what could have rotted? It's nothing but it's metal and, you know, welding things and stuff like that. Well, that required a good bit of work to get it off display and brought in some specialists from NRL and various other places. That is, I have their names here. Tim Seeley, John Hargrove on the left, Tim Seeley in the middle, and Robin O'Hearn on the right. And we took the camera apart, opened up the cassette, and I was hoping there would be film in it. I mean, even dead film. I can tell stories about finding film in instruments. And what they found was it was empty. There was no film, which makes a lot of sense, except that there was a good bit of corrosion in there. And where the corrosion came from, nobody really knows. But the cassette, you know, it was on the moon, it was brought back, but then it was hauled around all sorts of places in Houston, stuff like that. So something happened. So the whole point there at that point was to clean it up, restore it, and connect it back to the camera. By then, George was weakening. He was no longer active and retired. He was still doing some mentoring, but not too much. But he would still give lectures when invited, going on tours. And here's one I particularly like to show. Here's George and his wife, their second wife, at Huntsville, the museum, the Air and Space Museum in Huntsville. And he's looking at a diorama of Wrener von Braun, as you can well tell. The significance there for me is that von Braun wrote some of the earliest essays for the Collier series that got in the early 50s that got George all excited. And this sort of was closing the loop for him. And he talked about it and talked about it. It was really wonderful.
We used to have that series and my parents threw it away.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gee, when I get home, I'm going to see if I still have mine. yeah, I mean, that was an amazing series. So, as you probably know, George got amazing recognition for this work. He was designated the National Medal of Technology winner in his kind of the physical sciences engineering area. And the medal actually was bestowed in 2011, but it was made public in 2013. And I still haven't found out why there's that delay. Again, the NRL records are not completely open. But he was, of course, congratulated and turned into something of a legend at that time. So that's pretty much the story. This is the book that I wrote covering his life and all the details that I can't remember. very, very thankful that the Lemelson Center at Smithsonian guided the publication of this through MIT Press. And it's now been out since May. And I know that it's also an open source. So all you have to do is put my name and Carruthers into Google, and it'll come up with the MIT advertisement that if you wander through it, you'll eventually find the open source. But of course, if you actually want to buy the book, that'd be great too. So
when did he die?
2020, in December, early January. Sorry, I'm a little out. But I saw him about a month before he died at his home in Southwest, and his wife had called me over because She was very, very worried about all of the stuff they had in the house, all of the awards, the certificates, the letter, you know, the correspondence, stuff like that. I had managed to get her to agree that George's correspondence should be deposited various places. And it is. It's at some of it's at Howard. Some of it is in various places. But his widow had a lot more. And we finally got her to give us at the Air and Space Museum some of his more modern records. So we have those. Yeah, the last time I saw him, we were talking about what was in his collection still in his house. His wife was very, very worried. The reason why she called me in was that she was worried that somebody would come in and steal them, you know? And, well, but anyway, that's how we ended up with everything. It was quite a time. So I want to thank certainly the Naval Research Lab, the Lemelson Center, the AIP, and then the video histories that I used in this talk by the producers, Brian Williams and Andrew Ferguson. But I'd really like to also thank Jay for picking me up and bringing me here and taking me home, because my my wife and my daughter just took my license away. So anyway, any thoughts, any questions?
So you were asking about maybe who did the sketch on the Stardust cover. So that graphic actually has some initials in the lower left that says DN. So it probably wouldn't be that hard for someone to go through some of the old Stardust issues that you might mention.
ZN. ZN?
DN.
Oh, DN. Okay.
DN.
Yeah, that would be helpful because, when I use the image, I want to use it. I have used it in publications, and we couldn't give it a full citation.
Right. So it's
find out who the what the membership was back in
1970.
Yeah.
Now you were asking about the editor at that time, and that would have been Dr. John Legowick.
I don't think I knew the
question.
Yes.
Swearingen.
How would you use it before dying?
Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, how would you sum up what drove him, you know, in terms of, like, was it engineering, technology, like to explore space? What made him unique compared to other people to, you know, solve these problems that he had that kind of genius to find the right thing to do?
Oh, that's really a good question. And to the extent that he, well, when I interviewed him and asked him those sorts of questions, what attracted you to it? It was always he would look back on his fascination with space travel. And he wanted to do anything that supported that. And he was an instrument builder. His father put him in that mode, and he continued in that mode. And so he wanted to build instruments that would help discover the universe. And I mean, that I know is still pretty general, but there's nothing specific. As best as I could tell, he never considered any other activities. His professors, the people who were his advisors, they put him on a pretty narrow, friendly course to the Naval Research Lab. And that, I think, is partly because the NRL was, at the time, even in the, you know, post Sputnik era, the place for the space sciences.
It's following up, but did he have any hobbies, or was he so focused on his work?
That's a great question. I've tried to ask too, and everything was just his focused on his curiosity about making a better instrument. He was much more actively engaged in making something work than in what it did. No, I'm serious. Yeah. He almost said that to me. Other people at NRL said, yeah, George, you can go to George with any question on how to make something work. And if he can do it, he will, without any question of what you're going to do with it. You know, very, very interesting fellow. Extremely shy fellow. That actually, I know for a fact, because I interviewed a number of his mentees, students who work with him, and they said, you know, he didn't intimidate anybody. And the people who were well-meaning, wanting to learn and do things, they worked beautifully with him. And the others who were trying to make a splash, they just lost interest in him because he was not a promoter. Hope that's helpful.
Yes, that's really interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder if that kind of personality would kind of help him if you're like a self promoter. I mean, that can kind of have blowback too.
Well, that's an interesting question, but I go to since I have the word quiet in the title, that was a reason because I can't remember. She wrote a history of genius. And the title of the book is Quiet. And she had a lot of these biographical sketches of people who were just, you know, beyond the ken for figuring things out, but they were very, very quiet. George was not one of her examples, but it fit to a T. And you can find my book and it has the reference. I was going to bring a book and have everybody sign it, and then I forgot. Sorry about that.
I assumed you'd bring a stack of them to sell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they cost $75.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I got MIT Press to agree to make it open source, electronic open source. Certainly the Smithsonian was good with that, and the Lemelson Center was good with that. And I did know that would increase the price, but that was worth it because ideally, and this has happened, a lot of Washington high school and teachers and stuff have gotten it off the web. And I've gotten some nice feedback. Hey, they couldn't have afforded $75. And anyway, it's keyword addressable too. The one thing that ticked me off, though, is that originally it was one link and you can get the entire book as a PDF and it was searchable. No more. You can get it chapter by chapter, which really ticks me off. I asked MIT, you know, it wasn't MIT, it was Prentice Hall, which was their distributor. Just have to get beyond all that stuff. Any other questions? Yeah.
When you're doing the research and you have, I mean, a lot of it has been solved, the first person interview, if you interviewed him, how do you use also libraries, archives, Smithsonian libraries,
absolutely.
Library of Congress?
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's see. I interviewed about 40 people, at least 15, 20 archives. Every library I can get my hands on, I mean, that was related, at the University of Illinois and various other places. The American Institute of Physics was extremely valuable. I had learned how to do oral history when I worked there in the 70s. And they have remained, I would say, one of the most positive, supportive groups. You know the American Institute of Physics?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so sad that they moved downtown, but the archives are still out here.
They moved downtown? They're not over here?
No, the main offices have moved downtown. Will, the people who do the library and the academic stuff are still out in College Park.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the thing that ticks me off is that They used to have their seminars out there and their lectures. Uh-oh, they're downtown now. And that's weird.
Seniors meet out. Senior physicists still meet in College Park.
The AIP?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll ask
them. The senior physicists basically got kicked out of the old building because the American Center of Physics or whoever was running the building moved their operations downtown somewhere.
That's
they're a couple
right.
blocks off of the Metro Center, last I heard.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And the...
And none of my friends there were part of that.
Yeah, and the of the five floors, University of Maryland have occupied four. Theoretically, the fifth floor still belongs to the AIP, ACP, but it's not being used very much. And for various catch-22s, we could no longer even use the fifth floor. Because we don't officially have, you know, badges from the organization. It was always sort of informal.
Yeah.
So what happened was one of our members who a recently retired physics professor here from the University of Maryland, Ted Einstein, he basically talked to the chair of the physics department, and being a nice his name is Stephen Ralston, and being a nice guy, he basically said, come on over, and you can use our, you know, small conference rooms. And so our last two talks in June and September have been at the University of Maryland.
Okay.
So we're basically ensconced there now under, so it's similar to what NCA managed to do here with the astronomy department. We basically have to have a home somewhere.
Exactly. Okay. Oh, the guy, remember, Will Thomas. Do you know that name?
What?
Will Thomas.
No.
He is the he directs the library. He's one of the main names in the Niels Bohr Library.
Okay.
He doesn't run the whole show,
yeah,
but he's been extremely helpful, and he's been my primary contact now for years. I worked at the AIP when it was in New York, in the late 70s, and that was just a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. I learned oral history and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's also people at the Library of Congress who've been extremely helpful. And she's long retired, but I helped her appreciate the astronomy collection.
Are there any questions online?
Yes. Thank you very much for your talk. I really appreciate it.
Oh, David Dunham, what? Okay, sorry.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Was George into amateur telescope making at all? I know he was obviously professional, but did he build scopes just in his spare time?
Certainly earlier in his life, he built a 4-inch at the Adler Planetarium when he was a kid. And I believe that someone told me that he was still very helpful to kids who wanted to build telescopes. But I doubt if he built any more, you know, once he got into the space stuff.
Thank you.
Someone said he built a 6-inch reflector that is somewhere around here. That's all I know. But the 4-inch definitely is not, unfortunately. It was
That was a refractor, right?
No, reflector.
That was a reflector also.
He made reflectors.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've read somewhere that he'd made, his first telescope was with a lens that his dad found.
Oh, yeah. His dad, you know, popular science and stuff like that. They bought a little lens kit. His dad bought him a lens kit. And he put it together with cardboard tubes and stuff like that. Yeah, sure. But in terms of making the telescopes, the only ones he really made were several of the reflectors.
Okay. Yeah. Is CF still in good health, the science engineering apprenticeship program that he was involved with at NRL?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know. There's, yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I had a question, Dr. Dworkin. That hybrid design that you showed, the optical with the photocathode, the main reason
Speak
for doing
up.
that.
Speak up, Brian. We can't
Okay,
hear
sorry.
you.
It seems like I'm having an issue with the microphone. That design that you showed with the photocathode, the main reason for going with that was because it was extremely robust, correct? And could handle the punishment of launch on these sounding rockets and whatnot. Is that correct?
Well, the overall design was, yes. It was, of course, it had to work in a vacuum, but
Okay.
the way that
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, the question, well, first I was asking
No, I mean,
that particular design that was presented, right, that had the photocathode within the cast
please,
grain.
further back and can't hear
Please,
you.
let's let him ask his question.
Okay. So where I was going with that was I wanted to kind of understand, number one, what the motivation for going with that design was in the first place. And then second, what would the performance of that sort of a hybrid system using the technology of the time be relative to film, a film camera?
The improvement over photographic recording was about a factor of 20
Wow.
in the ultraviolet, but that's a very vague number. People say it's a lot more and that sort of thing. In the case of his design, the basic design, he basically just took what was a standard telescope design and he replaced the secondary, with a photo reflective photo cathode. Now, the innovation there that I had didn't point out is important. He really did some pioneering work on reflective photocathodes. Almost all of the astronomical photocathodes up to that time were transmissive. And he didn't like that because that also cut down the ultraviolet sensitivity. And so he was one of the first that did that. It also allowed him, he didn't have to put everything into a vacuum glass because as long as it outgassed quickly enough, it'll be working in a vacuum. Lalemann tubes, Krohn tubes, McGee tubes, all of the photoconductive and photo combination electronographic technologies they used. Vacuum tubes, which had a tendency to break.
Right.
Yeah, and in Carruthers' designs, the little camera I didn't show. I mean, there are pictures of his cameras, and they're that he's holding, and they're rugged. They are rugged.
Excellent. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, that Dr. Dworkin. Could you please repeat what his question was? I could barely hear him from back here.
Yes.
You're sitting right by
What was
the.
the advantage of the hybrid system that he designed?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah,
Thank
I
you.
mean, he knew. You know, what can I say? You have to go back and look at electronographic history in astronomy and how it was working. You've heard of Lalemant? Okay, he was the first person to create in the 30s electronographic cameras, but they were beasts. I mean, incredibly difficult to use. They had a lot of gain, but they were cantankerous because, oh yeah, the most crazy part of it is it was basically in a vacuum bottle. The cathode unit was in the vacuum bottle, and the film was there too. And once you exposed it, you had to break the bottle in order to get the film out. And so you had to make the tube all over again. And I'm not kidding. I mean, this was the Krohn tube, which was by the 1950s and others, were refinements. But just the operation of these things, and I'll give you a personal example. Sometime in the 60s, I worked at Lick Observatory, and I was the protector of the 36-inch refractor. I was the observer for the 36-inch, and that was used for all sorts of experimental stuff because, scientifically, it wasn't that competitive anymore. And there was this guy, Merle Walker,
who good astronomer, he was absolutely totally in enthralled with the Lalemand photoelectric or electronographic detectors, and he started using them, but he couldn't get telescope time on any of the like the 120 inch because it was too valuable. But he did get telescope time on the 36 inch. So I was babysitting with a telescope and watching him and his assistant, really interesting guy, go through all of the routine they had to go through to get this thing working. It was the most frustrating thing. I don't think they ever did anything useful. These were not very popular, but they were imaging devices. And the reason why they kept alive was because all of the work up to that time was either scanning, which is very, very hard to produce a physically reliable piece of image, using photography. And they wanted to find a way to image two-dimensional imaging electronically without going through any mid-steps. And the electronographic detectors were the design that was developed. Of course, all of that was completely instantly replaced by CCDs.
One difference I noted that on their diagram from a standard a telescope configuration, it looks like the primary would be creating the image directly on the photocathode. Of course, in the standard Cassegrain, that's not the case. The primary's image plane is behind the secondary. Is that correct?
Well, in this case, you can say that the primary focuses
right
onto the photocathode.
Right. That's what I was trying to say.
But then what happens when it turns it to electrons is
right.
There is this magnetic shield
right
that focuses that
right
onto the electronic sensitive
yeah
film.
Yeah.
But it not only focuses, it amplifies. And that's where the big factor came in. Not only was it very sensitive, but the electron beam could be amplified far more than, you know, a photon.
So would this be like a single electron, single photon coming in, make of a single star or of an area like the Earth or?
Well, your standard photoelectric photometers are point source.
Right.
These were area. Without scanning, not scanning, because the trouble with scanning for any, for many, many things it works. That's how a television works,
right?
It scans. But when you want to do real quantitative work, scanning is a problem.
Speaking of problems, how did Brothers do, you know, were his teachers and stuff supportive of him in like middle school, high school, and stuff like that?
I have no idea. There is no record. I know that he did quite well in contests where he would build things like model rockets and different things. And you know, what are they called? You know, the high school level
science fairs.
Science fairs. Thank you. Yeah.
But that was before World War II.
He was born, what, in 39, you said?
39, yeah.
Yeah, so the science fair really started after Sputnik, basically, didn't it?
Oh, no, I've got newsletter accounts of various science fairs that he was winning in the mid-50s.
Mid-50s.
And in fact...
Well, that's after Sputnik. No, it's
not. No. That's
57.
Right before him.
I made telescopes. I made a 4-inch, I made an 8-inch, and various others. And I exhibited at a science fair in Los Angeles. And I was about 12 years old. And so that makes it 1956. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then after World War II, though.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, George. All of that's after World War II. I have no idea what was happening before then, except my dad would tell me that he was in high school in Los Angeles, Chicago, and then Los Angeles. And there were competitions in districts, but it wasn't necessarily, it was more like quizzes, competitive exams and things like that, right. Not building things. But I was into building things. Yeah. I mean, that's how I felt. People asked me at one point, you know, how can I appreciate the life of a Black person just because he's in doing the science? And so in my book, I have a few pages of my affinity with him. We're both amateurs, both crazy about space, you know, one thing after another. Our fathers were both engineers, and it just went on that way. Trouble is, I didn't continue. I mean, George was a genius, absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions?
Oh,
go ahead.
Yeah. Let me say, so the telescope was completely manually operated by the astronauts?
Yeah, but there were also programming elements to it as well. They were taught, they had to follow a sequence,
sure.
A menu. And that's like, you know, putting it on the next dodge, you're doing that. But once the exposure started, they could walk away and do other things.
Oh, okay.
And then the camera would, how is it? No, it never could go to another source. It always needed the astronaut to do that. But there were plenty of times when if we're just changing a filter, the camera is able to change the filter.
Okay. Yeah.
So it could sit on one particular direction for several hours. And exposures were minutes. Yeah.
Did he get any recognition or have any relationship with Wernher von Braun?
No. Other than von Braun was his idol. You saw that picture of him in front of the von Braun thing. Huntsville, Alabama was a big part of Crothers' family. His brother who is here, and he's been extremely helpful to me. I've interviewed him, and he's piled all sorts of neat stuff on me, you know, mainly if I put it away in the museum. They were engineer. He was an engineer at in Huntsville, and it was aeronautic and astronautic stuff. So that was in the family, very much. By then, that was a lot later, but certainly earlier, before college. I don't think so. I did ask Gerald Carruthers, his younger brother. Was his brother an inspiration? And in one level, he says, yes, but I know I could never be him. I couldn't do what he does because he had an inexhaustible attention. George did, but Gerald had a life. And George would have, I mean, from what I know of him, knew of him, it didn't bother him. He was so intent on what he, you know, his love of the of building things that did things. Yeah.
Were the images taken on the moon, were they long enough exposure that it needed any tracking? Or
no.
Think about how slow the moon rotates.
Right. Yeah, 6 degrees. What is it, 6 degrees an hour? Something like that. Pardon? I have it in my... I have a somewhere. No, oh, it went...
12 degrees per day.
That's it. Yeah. Sorry. I got it mixed up. I have it in my notes here somewhere. But his imaging was also rather wide field and short exposure. The spectroscopy needed longer exposures, but it wasn't imaging, so it was not position dependent. So those two things work pretty well. Yep.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dvorkin.
Thank you. We've been a very kind audience.
Very fascinating talk.
Thank you.
Okay, so I assume there's no jogging tonight.
No, it was pretty cloudy earlier.
Raining. Is it raining?
Elizabeth?
Yes, sir.
I think the illustrator's name was David Norden.
David Norden?
That's okay. Jay may know him, may have known him.
David Norden?
I don't remember.
I'll try to write it down. D-N, David Norden, right?
N-O-R-D-I-N.
N-O-R-D-I-N.
If you look at the April and May issues, 1970.
David Norden.
Yeah, that'll be very helpful.
Does Nassim have maybe something online?
Yeah, if you look at April and May, it looks like it's him. There's one with his writing and then one with his printed name.
Optics, which in May. Or something like that. I mean, is there something accessible to the public?
Once we got
it. The National
Thank Institute. You.
What?
You're welcome.
I mean,
the
website? Yeah. Well, what is this? Or
you can
go past. University.
Not as much as it has behind just the wall, you know. It has a ton of stuff online, but it's not public. The stuff that is public, though, are the
I'm gonna stop the recording.
Tons of articles.
It would have been faster.
You can go to the NASA website and
it's not that far.